Redeemer Adult Education presents Dr. Jeffrey Beshears, speaking on the life and work of C.S. Lewis, A Mere Christian. In session two, he discusses The Conversion. It was recorded on June 12, 2011, in Rudisill Hall at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Midtown, Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, good. Thank you. Well, it's nice to be back with you, and certainly looking forward to what we'll be talking about this morning. One of my more favorite topics, I would say, and that is the conversion experience of C.S. Lewis. It's a very, very inspiring story, and I think you'll be duly edified as a result. Before we get started, I wanted to just reference the handout up here. I assume everyone has a copy of the handout with... It's this form, so please help yourself to it if you didn't get a copy yet. And you notice there on the front side, page one, is basically an outline of more or less what we covered last week, the significance of C.S. Lewis, and why we oftentimes refer to him as a mere Christian, mere in the sense of being a basic fundamental Christian, not a fundamentalist, but a Christian who holds to the core doctrines of the Christian faith, or as he would oftentimes describe himself, a great tradition Christian. So are there any comments or questions related to anything we talked about last week, anything that could use some clarification before we move on into the study for this morning? Anything? Yes, please.
When you see him as an apologist,
yes,
Christian apologist, do you see him in a long apologist? And so, what would that mean?
Well, that's an excellent question, because Christian apologist. I'm sorry. Repeat the question. Is C.S. Lewis essentially in a traditional line of Christian apologists, I guess going back several generations or centuries? I'm glad you raised that issue, because today Christian apologetics is really one of the cutting edge areas of Christian theology. You know, we oftentimes say, and many churches, not all certainly, but many churches strongly emphasize theology, essentially just literally the study of God. And oftentimes, the emphasis is on what our denomination, what our tradition has historically taught about the nature and character of God and the nature of man and so on. And essentially, theology is what we believe, or at least what we are supposed to believe. Now, apologetics is actually a subset of theology. Apologetics is basically the arguments as to why we should believe these things. So theology is essentially what we believe. Apologetics is why we should believe these things. In other words, apologetics sets forth, you might say, the factual and the rational bases for the Christian faith. So today there is a great emphasis on Christian apologetics, and this is understandable given the fact that our society and culture is becoming more diverse, more multicultural all the time, and the old sort of generic Christian consensus of the past is eroding very, very rapidly. So today, people demand that we explain and give palatable reasons for what Christians believe. You know, we oftentimes make the point in apologetics that there are many reasons why people identify with the Christian faith. For some, it's a matter of tradition, cultural, family heritage, and so on. For others, they find certain social advantages to being a church member, identifying with the Christian faith. For many people, it's a psychological factor more than anything else. But when all is said and done, there's really only one fundamental reason why anybody should want to be a Christian. And that is if, in fact, Christianity is true. If it's not true, then frankly, it's a great waste of time, a great waste of time and energy and resources. So there is today, as I said, a strong emphasis on apologetics. Now, as far as C.S. Lewis and his approach to apologetics, he was very much influenced by G.K. Chesterton, who preceded him by several decades. We usually cite Chesterton as sort of the father of 20th century Christian apologetics. Now, actually, if you go back into the 19th, 18th, 17th centuries, you don't really find a lot of Christian apologetics, frankly. And back in the medieval period, very little emphasis on apologetics. Oftentimes, a strong emphasis on theology in general, but not apologetics. Now, can you imagine why that would have been the case? Why is it that apologetics has really just emerged as a major force in the 20th century, especially in the second half of the 20th century? But if we go back deeper into Christian history, there really has not been that much emphasis all the way back to the first several centuries. Any ideas as to why that might be the case?
Church universal.
Pardon me?
The church universal in the culture.
Okay, can you sort of elaborate on that? You say the church universal in the culture.
The permeation of Western society by the Catholic Church or the Christian Church.
Okay, in the past. Okay, which is eroding in more modern times. Yes, sir?
I would say the church, whatever education there was church controlled. So
yes.
The educated people would not be questioning the church.
Right.
And also science, too, and something like that. They had the science.
Yeah, good point. So there was at least a nominal Christian or a pseudo-Christian culture during that period, and very few were actually in challenging the unique truth claims of the Christian faith. Now, again, in the 20th century, that changes, and it changes dramatically. And you mentioned science in particular, the rise of Darwinian naturalistic scientific theory and so on, among other forces. Freudian psychology, Marxism, and so on. All these launched a broadside attack on the integrity, the intellectual credibility of the Christian faith. And so eventually Christians will begin to mount a very vigorous defense of the Christian faith. But it'll be well into the 20th century. And actually, some of you are very well versed in Christian apologetics. And you know that of the vast amount of rich apologetic literature and resources there are in our culture today, 90% of it has been produced in only the last 15 years or so. So it is really exploding, and at the opportune time. As our culture becomes more degraded, as there's more and more bold anti-Christian attacks, it makes total sense that Christians would be more attuned to defending the integrity, the rational, and the factual bases of our faith. I believe there was another comment, question.
Yes. I admit that in medieval times, the tremendous influence of the Roman Catholic Church,
yes.
And then slightly later in England, when the Church of England came into being, you could hardly separate church from state.
That's right.
And the majority of the people were the peasant or the serf class. Mm-hmm. And essentially, they didn't think for themselves.
No, they.
And I think one of the big differences in this, as we have gotten into more individual and personal freedom, and people start questioning and challenging. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you're coming from.
Yeah. So in other words, in the past, more and more people, far more people than presently, just believed whatever they were told by authority figures, their pastor, their priest, and so on, and the percentage of the population that was fairly well educated, of course, wasn't very high prior to the 20th century. So people essentially just believed, basically unquestioned, or accepted unquestioned what they were told by authority figures, and that no longer is the case. But what it does is open up a tremendous opportunity for Christians that are dedicated and committed to sharing the truth and the integrity of the gospel to be able to do so. There are more challenges to our faith today, but there's more opportunities, I think, to share, again, the core basics of the faith. Yes?
One other example that strikes me as being very similar to Lewis is Pascal in the in the 17th century in France.
Yeah.
And he also had very a sort of very similar experience with Lewis of being influenced by science, and was a scientist.
Right. Scientist and a philosopher.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then was not well received by the Catholic Church either.
There are isolated individuals that you could cite as having put forth an apologetic for the Christian faith in the modern history, early modern history, including Pascal would be, of course, one of the best. But it's, again, really not until after the French Revolution, certainly, and after the rise of Darwinism and Freudianism and Marxism and so on, that apologetics really surfaces as a frontline issue in Christianity. And again, today there are just wonderful resources available for those who take the time and expend the energy to delve into it. So C.S. Lewis really has relatively few predecessors in this field, and I think all modern apologists today, to some extent or another, owe a great debt to Lewis. Let's see, I believe there was...
As a mass communication, the development, continued development over the last generation, or last century, has made the subject more available to people. People were limited in their knowledge and amount, but mass communications has just expanded tremendously.
Well, and again, the challenges to the Christian faith, atheists and skeptics of all sorts are far more bold today than they ever were in the past. And again, in the past, it was actually risky to challenge the church, wasn't it? In medieval times, and even at certain times in early modern history, it was actually hazardous to challenge the church on anything. Now, it's open season, of course. And so again, it makes it all the more imperative that we be well prepared to make the case for the truth of the Christian faith based on history, based on science, based on reason. And again, we have many, many excellent examples of people that do just that today. Many Christians who go into high-profile debates with leading atheists, renowned atheists, and other skeptics, and to say the least, they more than hold their own against these people. Anything else? Any other comments, questions? I thought I saw another hand. Yes, please.
Skepticism, I think, has grown more in the last half century.
Yes.
We question everything.
Yes.
We don't take things. We want to know why.
Right.
We want to be shown proof. We're very proof-oriented.
Yes, so there is an awful lot of skepticism and outright cynicism today. Now, some of the intellectual challenges to the Christian faith probably come from fairly honest, sincere skeptics. Most do not. Most are really just a cover for people's desires to be their own moral authority, frankly. But there are honest questions and challenges, and we need to be well prepared and well versed to address those. And C.S. Lewis is such a sterling example in that respect. So let's take a look at how C.S. Lewis comes to faith And by the way, there on page one of your outline, you see near the bottom of the page the various steps we outlined last week in Lewis's faith journey from nominal Christianity to becoming a pretty hardcore skeptic, cynic, atheist, and then the various other stages before he finally arrives at a full and complete faith in Jesus Christ. You know, C.S. Lewis was raised in a fairly intellectual climate, a fairly intellectual household. Books were everywhere, and he had free access. This is back, of course, before all the distractions of television and you know, computers and so on. And he was able to just indulge his imagination and his intellect without any real boundaries. His parents were very bookish, pretty intelligent people, but neither of them was particularly aesthetic oriented. In other words, Lewis later writes in his autobiography about his home life being, again, somewhat intellectually stimulating, but quite devoid of artistic beauty. And actually, even though we oftentimes remember Lewis as this great intellect, which he was actually by nature a romantic. He was actually by nature more of an aesthete, someone who appreciated the aesthetic aspects of life. Now, One event early in life in particular stirred this sense of beauty and imagination in Lewis. He was only about 7 years old at the time. And again, this event occurs that really sort of awakens his sense of mystery and wonderment. One day, he writes, "My brother brought a lid of a biscuit tin, which he had covered with moss and garnished with twigs and flowers so as to make it into sort of a toy garden or a toy forest." So you can imagine a biscuit, the lid of a biscuit can. And his brother Warren has garnished this with all kinds of twigs and flowers. And it looked to Lewis like a toy forest or garden. He says, "This was the first beauty that I ever knew, and it made me aware of nature." And he goes on to write, "As long as I live, my imagination of paradise will retain something of my brother's toy garden." Now, this is, I think, really interesting and good insight into Lewis's psyche, because he's absolutely mesmerized, for some reason, he's absolutely mesmerized by the simple beauty of this little toy garden. And something about that stirs his romantic sensibilities, and something about that actually calls him to sort of a world beyond this present world. It's basically a transcendent or mystical experience. Lewis writes, "It was something quite different from ordinary life. Something they would say now was in another dimension." Now, this strange sense of beauty that he found in this is what Lewis will later refer to as joy, with a capital J. And he tells us, you know, joy is more than just to be fascinated by something. Joy is more than just simple pleasure or having your imagination stirred. He says joy is actually an indescribable and transcendent longing. It's an unsatisfied desire, which is itself more desirable than any other satisfaction. And he goes on to write, "It's difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation that came over me." Now, again, see, I have a hard time relating to this. And when I was Lewis's age at this point, I was living back in the 50s. And it wasn't nearly as overstimulated a society and culture as it is today. As you know, things have changed drastically in the last 20, 30, 40 years. And at the time C.S. Lewis grew up, the culture had changed drastically, of course, from culture in the 1950s or 60s. So he's not totally overstimulated. And as a result, he can appreciate and value the most simple beauty, beautiful things in life. He's not, again, just absolutely distracted by entertainment and pop culture and so on. So, again, every time I encounter this story, it leaves me a little bit mystified. But keep in mind, he's living in a culture that's a whole lot more conducive to thinking and to the development of the imagination than culture later would become. So he says, you know, it's difficult to find words strong enough for the sensation that came over me. John Milton's term, enormous bliss, comes somewhere close to what I felt. It was a sensation, of course. It was a desire, but a desire for what? And he goes on to say, now, before I knew what it was I actually desired, the desire itself was gone, and the world turned commonplace again. It had taken only a moment of time, and in a certain sense, everything else that had ever happened to me was insignificant by comparison. So basically, this is Lewis's first, you might say, mystical experience. It's the beginning of his awareness that this world is merely, as he would say, the shadowlands. In other words, this world is only a dim imitation of true reality. Now, those of you who know philosophy know this is a very Platonic view, you know, of reality, and Lewis is influenced somewhat by that Platonic view of life. But for years thereafter, Lewis, of course, would try to manufacture joy by some form of pleasure, either by reading inspiring literature or through some other form of pleasure, including sexual indulgence. But none of it sufficed. They were all very, very unfulfilling substitutes for what he had experienced at this time when he was 7 years old, and occasionally in years after that. Now, we talked a little bit last week about how Lewis's mother dies at age 9. He's immediately shipped off to a very harsh, authoritarian English boarding school, and it really has a coarsening effect on his life. And as a schoolboy and as an adolescent, Lewis describes himself as a blaspheming atheist. He had thoroughly renounced the Christian faith, wanted absolutely nothing to do with it. And it's easy to understand why this would have been the case based on his childhood experiences and also his adolescent experiences. We have to take into account, of course, the death of his mother, the lack of any sort of home life that he had, certainly lack of any kind of normal home life, and of course the cruelty of his English boarding school experience all led him to believe that this is a very cold, cruel, purposeless, random universe. And of course, somebody that's bought into that mindset is a good candidate for agnosticism or atheism, and frankly, a good candidate for a nihilistic or nihilistic worldview perspective. Now, Lewis's skepticism when it comes to religion and Christianity in particular is also inflamed by some of the reading he's doing as a teenager. And in particular, George Frazer's very popular book back in these days, The Golden Bough. Some of you may be familiar with The Golden Bough. George Frazer was sort of the Joseph Campbell of his day. He held an evolutionary view of religion, that religion is merely man-made. It's merely wish projection. It's an attempt to manufacture security in the face of reality, a very cold, cruel, impersonal, random universe. And so, psychologically, people desperately want to imagine that there's somebody in control, they want to desperately imagine there's a God, and furthermore, that this God is a benevolent force. So that's the case that George Frazer and others like him would put forth. And Lewis buys into this anti-theology wholesale by the time he's 13 years old. In fact, that along with the fact that he's reading a lot of Freud, and he's being influenced tremendously by Freud's idea that religion is merely a myth. Again, this idea that religion is really just a search for a divine father figure, somebody to shelter us and protect us in this very cold, cruel, dangerous world. So when he's 13 years old, Lewis will write to one of his friends back in Ireland, "You know, I think that I believe in no religion at all. There's absolutely no proof for any of them. And from a philosophical point of view, Christianity is not even the best. All religions, in other words, all mythologies, are merely man's own invention." Now, this holds true for Christ as much as for any other myth, he says. "Primitive man found himself surrounded by all sorts of terrible things that he didn't understand. And so religion, or mythology, grew up. Often, too, great men were regarded as gods after their death. And thus, after the death of the Hebrew philosopher Yeshua," he says, whose name we've corrupted into Jesus, "he became regarded as a god. And a cult sprang up around him, connected with ancient worship of Yahweh. And so Christianity came into being. One mythology among many." Now, as I mentioned earlier, there are legitimate, you might say, intellectual questions when it comes to the nature of reality and the nature of God. But most of what poses for religious skepticism is more of a cover, again, for immorality. And I think the more you look into the backgrounds of especially the most vociferous atheists and skeptics and agnostics, the more obvious this becomes. You know, as Lewis writes in Mere Christianity, there's really only two types of people in this world. There are those who say to God, "Thy will be done." And there are those to whom God says, "Thy will be done." And so the hardcore skeptic is a person who wants to deify himself. It's not just the New Age that calls for self-deification, although it's very overt about that. It's many other belief systems as well as religious skepticism in general. And during this period in his life, Lewis, of course, has an awful lot of pent-up anger. And as a result, he is mad at God, even though he doesn't believe in God. He's still mad. He's mad at the universe. He's mad at the way his life has been managed and controlled and arranged. And so he will write in his, in Mere Christianity, he'll write, "You know, I was living at this time of my life, like so many atheists and anti-theists, I was living in a whirl of contradictions. Now, I maintained that God does not exist. I was also very angry with God for not existing. I was equally angry with him for creating this world." Now, furthermore, see, nothing that Lewis has ever experienced in church or anything he's ever experienced about Christianity has been appealing to him one bit. Certainly not Christian morality. He refers to the Christian God as a transcendent meddler or a cosmic interferer. In other words, he's somebody that's constantly trying to interrupt your fun. Okay, and now that's a very, very immature, you know, concept of God. But frankly, many non-believers have that idea that God is this cosmic interferer that's looking down, trying to control our lives, and trying to spoil all of our fun. And that certainly was Lewis's view of God at this time in his life. Now, furthermore, the externals of Christianity had absolutely no appeal to him. He saw nothing at all beautiful in Christianity. He says, in fact, he writes in his autobiography, "Christianity in my mind, was mostly associated with ugly architecture, ugly music, and bad poetry. Of course, he'd never, you know, come to a worship service at Redeemer here, so he'd never heard beautiful, glorifying music and rather pleasant architecture, I'd say, as well. Now, despite the fact that he is a very proud atheist, he's never really content with just a purely materialistic worldview. Because frankly, a purely materialistic worldview, a universe without God, can lead to nothing but abject despair. If you follow it to its logical conclusion, it has to end in nihilism. And now, most skeptics don't want to go that far. Because, frankly, by the time you arrive at nihilism, there's absolutely no reason to get up in the morning. Life has absolutely no purpose whatsoever. All is vanity. All is absurd. So most people stop short of outright nihilism. But if carried through to its logical conclusion, that's where you would end up. Lewis doesn't want to go there. He wants to imagine that there is, in fact, beauty and truth and reality and purpose in this life. So how do we access that? Well, he thinks that it comes through, the aesthetic areas of life, and through mysticism. And one of his heroes at this time is the popular poet William Butler Yeats. Yeats was very much involved in the occult, in a particular aspect of the occult called theosophy. And this influenced Lewis quite a bit, because he believed that Yeats was this great thinker, this great intellectual, and here's a man who actually believes that there is a supernatural realm of life. And this has quite an influence on Lewis, that there's actually intelligent people who are non-materialists or non-naturalists, who actually are supernaturalists, even if in this case we're talking about somebody involved in the occult. Now, at this point, and in a very unexpected way, Lewis is touched by divine grace. It happens one day when he's waiting for a train to arrive, and he goes into a book stall and just randomly picks up a book and starts thumbing through it. Now, this is a book by George MacDonald, and the title is Fantasties, and it's a book that immediately stirs the spiritual sensitivities of Lewis and profoundly impacts his life. And as it turns out, this George MacDonald, as much as anyone, along with somebody like Chesterton, who's appealing to Lewis's rational side, but MacDonald is appealing to the mystical, intuitive part of Lewis's nature, and becomes a very, very strong influence on Lewis in his progression toward Christianity. In fact, he says, after having read that book, my imagination was in a real sense baptized. And he goes on to write that I had not the faintest notion why I bought that book, but he read it and he called it a great literary experience. And again, it's sort of an intimation that there is a realm of reality beyond just the physical material world. Now, one of Lewis's biographers, George Sayer, has written that the influence of this book lasted for many years and perhaps his whole life. Lewis was aware that it purified his imagination, making all of his erotic and magical perversions of joy appear sordid and unworthy. When people revel in drugs and sex and so on, or just revel in pleasure, what they're pursuing is a transcendent experience. I mean, we all know that, but it's all artificial. And in fact, it can be very, very dangerous. And but when Lewis encounters real joy, spiritual reality, it makes all that other stuff appear very base and corrupt and sordid and, as he says, unworthy by comparison. Let me just pause briefly before we turn now to the portion that's included there in your outline. starting on page two there, a most reluctant convert. Are there any comments, any questions, anything that could use some clarification before we move on? I was reading something a few years ago. It said, you know, when you're speaking public, when you ask a question, you should wait 7 seconds for an answer, which can seem like sort of an eternity, you know, approaching eternity. But, you know, it actually works in that sixth or seventh second. Oftentimes, you get some interesting responses. I'm sorry, we're beyond the 7 seconds now. Go ahead.
How old did you say C.S. Lewis was when he read Fantastes?
Let's see, I think he's about... how old was Lewis when he read Fantastes by George MacDonald? He's around 13 or so. And he's just an intellectual sponge. He's devouring everything. And you know what... We talked last week about his tutor, William Kirkpatrick, the great Knock. This is a man who basically prepared Lewis for entry into the university. Now, when Lewis is living with Kirkpatrick, Lewis is about, I think, 15 or 16, something like that. And there's a comment that Kirkpatrick makes about Lewis that's very insightful. He says, you know, Clive, he called him Clive, has a literary nature about him that's quite unusual. And furthermore, he has the ability to discern between great literature and second-rate, mediocre literature, and he's not even remotely interested in the mediocre. And again, this is pretty phenomenal to be speaking like that about somebody 15, 16 years old. Now, again, Lewis's sensibilities had not been so corrupted by pop culture. There was, as you know, pop culture back then, but it didn't have nearly the influence and effect on young people that it has since the 50s and 60s. So here's somebody who recognizes great literature, and he just immerses himself in it. He revels in it. And he's not even remotely interested in second-rate stuff. You know, there's this economic theory. Many of you would be better versed and be able to explain this better than I. But I know there's an economic theory in regards to stock market investment and so on, and that is that bad money drives out good money. And again, some of you, I'm sure, could explain that concept a lot better than I. But I oftentimes think of that concept when it comes to culture in general. Bad culture corrupts and overwhelms good culture. And there is, obviously, there's always been some good pop culture. But it's oftentimes so overwhelmed by the mediocre and the bad. So Lewis, being raised, you know, 100 years ago, doesn't have to contend with certainly as much as we do today, and especially our young people. Now let's turn to the section of your outline there. As I said, on page two, a most reluctant convert. And it was through Lewis's study of literature that he's constantly being exposed to the spiritual side of life. This comes through the works of George MacDonald, for instance. It also comes through Chesterton. And it comes through a man, particularly a man named George Herbert, who was a 17th century pastor, Anglican pastor. In fact, many of you are probably familiar with George Herbert because he's actually commemorated on the March 1st calendar of saints in the in the ELCA. He was a poet and a pastor, a clergyman, and his poetry deeply affected Lewis. Now, Lewis writes in his autobiography that the more he's reading, the more these books are turning against me. I must have been as blind as a bat not to have seen it. The ludicrous contradiction between my theory of life, his skepticism, atheism, and my actual experiences as a reader. Now, George MacDonald had done more to me than any other writer, of course, and it was a pity that he had this bee in his bonnet about Christianity. But he was good in spite of believing in Christianity. Also, Chesterton had more sense than all the other modern thinkers put together. Even among ancient writers, he says, the ones who are the most impressive, like Plato, for instance, are those who are the most spiritually inclined, as opposed to the hardcore naturalists, secularists, and so on. He says, on the other hand, those writers who did not suffer from religion and with whom, in theory, my sympathy ought to have been complete, all these kind of people seem to me to be thin. It wasn't that I didn't like them. They were very entertaining, but that's about all. They were only entertaining. He goes on to say there was no depth in these people. He says, but the most alarming of all was George Herbert. Now, here was a man who seemed to me to exceed all the authors that I had ever read in terms of expressing the very quality of life as we actually live it from moment to moment. But the wretched fellow, instead of doing it all directly, insisted on mediating it through what I called Christian mythology. On the other hand, most of the authors who might be claimed as precursors of modern enlightenment, in other words, secularists, seemed to me quite puny by comparison, and frankly, they bored me. The only non-Christians who seemed to me to really know anything were the Romantics, and many of the Romantics were tinged by something like religion or spirituality, and sometimes even tinged by association with Christianity. So, here's his summation. I was drawn to the conclusion that Christians are wrong, but all the rest are bores. Wow. What insight. He doesn't believe that Christianity is true yet, but the only people with insight and depth are the Christian writers. The anti-Christian folks, those that are so hostile, are frankly just thin, superficial, and after a while, they're not even entertaining anymore. They're bores. But, of course, at this point in his life, he's still pretty antagonistic toward Christianity. He says, you know, as a child, he had endured so many dreary church services and so many dreary sermons. Remember, his grandfather was the pastor of the church. And furthermore, as I said a while ago, he detested church music and really resented the hours spent that he had to go to chapel services, you know. And he also was very concerned as he got older by his tendency to want to escape from reality into fantasy, okay? Again, he's got an incredible imagination, but he understands that that needs to be kept somewhat in check, or else it can become very irresponsible and an escape from reality. And furthermore, see, at this point in his life, Lewis sees absolutely no connection whatsoever between Christianity and the kind of sensations of joy that he occasionally experiences. He hasn't connected the dots yet. Now, in Lewis's mind, there is no meaning and purpose in life except what we imagine there might be. In other words, everything ends in futility. And so as he examines the various belief systems that he's sampled in his life up to this point, this would include atheism, it would include what we might call aestheticism, in other words, finding meaning and truth and beauty, meaning and truth in life through beauty, art, music, and so on. Romanticism, various philosophies, various spiritualities, Freudian psychoanalysis. All of this, Lewis says, is a dead end. None of it's fulfilling. And in fact, he says, Christianity held the only possible solution, but only if it were true. Takes us back to the whole basis for apologetics. So See, if what we're talking about, if what's preached and sung about, and what we read in our Bibles and so on, if ultimately this doesn't comport to reality, then we're just living in illusion. Ultimately, it has no meaning whatsoever. So Lewis is beginning to sense that Christianity is the only way out of nihilistic despair, but it's only a way out if, in fact, it's actually true. Now, 5 years after he joined the faculty at Magdalen College, in other words, he'll be in his late 20s at this point, Lewis experiences a spiritual epiphany. Gradually over the years, he had been drawn to a belief that there is an absolute reality and an absolute truth. And virtually all the major influences in his life, and this includes a lot of his personal contacts with some of his academic colleagues, all of these influences had active religious and spiritual lives. So the people that he's reading and the people that he's interacting with who most influence him, these are people, generally speaking, of faith. Now, his favorite contemporary writer is Chesterton, and Chesterton, of course, is a great influence. In fact, Chesterton's greatest apologetic work is called The Everlasting Man, and that book sets forth a very Christ-centered view of human history, and the more Lewis read it and thought about it, the more convinced he became that it was actually true. Now, sometime around 1926, 1927, he has a very strange encounter with an academic colleague that really shakes his skepticism, because he's engaged in a very casual discussion in his dorm room with another scholar there at Magdalen College, a man named Harry Weldon. And Harry Weldon was known on campus as one of the most profane, blasphemous, hardcore skeptics among all the faculty. There was a lot of competition for that, title, and then Weldon was as bad as any, a hardcore cynic. And Lewis and Weldon are just casually talking about certain historical oddities, as Lewis called it, historical oddities, strange, weird things in history. And Weldon makes the comment that, you know, there's good evidence to support the historicity of the Gospels. Now, Lewis is taken aback, to say the least. And Weldon goes on to say, rum thing, all that stuff in George Frazer's book, you know, The Golden Bough, about a dying God, you know, it almost looks as if it actually happened once. Well, Lewis is absolutely astonished by this very casual remark, and actually when he tried to sort of press Weldon on it, Weldon didn't want to go any farther and just change the subject. But Lewis is astonished by this comment, and so he resolves to investigate the matter for himself. And he begins ruminating on Chesterton's book. He begins reading the Gospels seriously for the first time in his life. And he comes to the conclusion that the Gospels are not, in fact, legends. These are actual historical narratives. Now, nobody knows literature better than C.S. Lewis, even at this young point in his life. He is one of the world experts on literature at this point. And he knows very clearly the difference between legend and historical narrative. And he begins to believe that the Gospels are actually true accounts. They're not just mythological, legendary accounts. Now, impulsively and really unintentionally, more or less, he begins attending church. It just seems like the thing to do. Now, he doesn't enjoy it. It'll be years before he can actually enjoy the experience. But he knows, or I should say he senses, that there's truth there. And he wants to be in the presence of those who believes. Now, spiritually, a great turning point in his life comes in the summer of 1929. One of his biographers writes, Lewis began to feel himself approached by God. And in the summer of 1929, he went through a mystical experience. It happened on a bus going to going back home to see the woman, the older woman, sort of a mother figure that he was living with at the time, Mrs. Moore's house. He says he began to feel that something was binding him, sort of like he was in a suit of armor, and or you might say encased in a shell. And in this moment of illumination, he realized that he could either stay encased in this shell or he could take it off. And after this strange sensation, he felt as if he were a snowman, at least or at last beginning to melt. Now, sometime after this, in his room at Magdalen College, Lewis writes that he finally gave in and admitted his belief in God. He writes, "Remember, I had always wanted, above all other things, not to be interfered with." And of course, the great cosmic interferer, you know, is the one he's been avoiding all these years. He says, "I had wanted to call my soul my own." He wanted to be the captain of his own soul, his own Lord, his own God. "I had been far more anxious to avoid suffering than to achieve delight." Boy, again, great insight. Do we go through life more concerned with avoiding discomfort and suffering, or is our passion in life to achieve true illumination? "You must picture me alone in that room at Magdalen College, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted, even for a second, from my work, feeling this steady, unrelenting approach of him who so earnestly I desired not to meet." God is approaching, and frankly, that's the last person he wants to meet. "Finally, I gave in, and I admitted that God was God, and I knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England." The hound of heaven had finally apprehended him. Pardon me?
Any proof you ever read Hound of Heaven? That's what I was thinking about in your description.
I'm almost sure he must have. I mean, it was written before Lewis's time, wasn't it? I'm not sure how old that poem is. But I imagine he probably had read The Hound of Heaven. Now, a couple of years after his conversion, now, by the way, this is only a conversion away from atheism or whatever. This is only a theistic conversion. But a couple of years later, he takes the next step and declares his belief in Jesus Christ. Now, Lewis had been studying comparative religions. And in his mind, the question was not which is the one true religion, but rather, the real question was, which religion is the most full and mature expression of divine revelation? Now, in his mind, the only two options are Christianity or, he says, Hinduism. Now, it's not the kind of pop Hinduism that most people are familiar with. He's talking about the Vedic tradition, basically, the ancient origins for what later became Hinduism. So in Lewis's mind, these are the only two options, Christianity or, you know, ancient Vedic Indian belief. Everything else, he says, was either a preparation for this or else it was a corruption of this. Now, he disqualifies Hinduism on two accounts. First of all, it provides absolutely no philosophical basis for morality and ethics. This is not to say that there are not relatively moral and ethical Hindus. It's merely to say that there is no philosophical basis for it in their belief system. And secondly, he disqualifies Hinduism because it's a purely esoteric, it's a purely mythical belief system, and it has absolutely no historical foundation at all. Christianity, however, is a historically based faith system. So one night in September 1931, he invites a couple of his academic friends over, J.R.R. Tolkien and a man named Hugo Dyson, and they have dinner, and then they go out for a stroll, and they begin theologizing. And Lewis explains that he loves reading and thinking about mythology, But he certainly can't regard mythology as being in any way true. And furthermore, he says, you know, I also cannot see any personal relevance in the story of Christ. Now, it's a fascinating story. It's a very inspiring story when it comes to self-sacrifice, but I just can't frankly relate to it. And Tolkien points out that Lewis is mired in what Tolkien says is an imaginative failure. He's stuck in an imaginative rut, basically. And Tolkien says that myths tell us something about divine truth, although oftentimes in distorted form. So myth tells us something about divine truth, although oftentimes it's been perverted and distorted over time. Now, according to Tolkien, Lewis needs to understand that the story of Christ is simply this. It's simply a true myth. It's a myth working on us in the same way that other myths do, but with one difference, and this makes all the difference in the world. The so-called Christian myth actually really happened. It's not only mythological, it's historical. And that's what sets it apart from all others. And furthermore, Tolkien says, doctrines which we extract from myth are actually less true than the myth itself, because these ideas are too large and too encompassing for any finite mind to absorb. And that's why God has primarily revealed himself, Tolkien says, through story form. Now, years later, Lewis will write to a friend, "What flows into you from myth is not truth, but reality. And therefore, every myth becomes the father of innumerable truths on an abstract level." Now, the other fellow engaged in the conversation, Hugo Dyson, added that, furthermore, Lewis needed to consider that Christianity actually works. In other words, it actually provides forgiveness of sins, it provides peace with God, and it allows for a spiritual rebirth. And so anyway, they have this very engaging conversation, and then his friends leave about 4 o'clock in the morning. And 9 days later, Lewis and his brother, Warney, get on a motorcycle for an outing to the local zoo. And in his spiritual autobiography, Lewis writes that when I got into that motorcycle, when we set off for the zoo, I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, but when we got to the zoo, I did. And this is one, I mean, this is so typical, you know, of Lewis, the way he thinks, the way he writes. And you might, well, that's ridiculously, you know, esoteric. Well, what's he mean? Well, he doesn't want to explain it, because it truly is a spiritual phenomenon. And he never really tells us exactly what's going on in his mind. Now, many people have taken motorcycle rides and tried to replicate his conversion. And, you know, God works uniquely in each of us. So I don't think that riding a motorcycle necessarily is going to provide, you know, spiritual illumination. But Lewis later writes to his friend, "I have just passed on from believing in God to definitely believing in Christ." And this is, again, more than just an intellectual awakening. It truly is a transcendent experience. See, all his life he had been longing for joy, some sort of transcendent experience that gave him peace and oneness with God. And now, having surrendered his life to Jesus Christ, this search for joy is complete. And in fact, he writes something very insightful. He says, you know, to tell you the truth, this subject of joy has really lost nearly all interest for me ever since I became a Christian. It was only valuable as a pointer to something other and outer. So it was only an intimation of divine reality. And once he's apprehended that and committed to that, he no longer is searching for, you might say, peak experiences, you know, to use, who was it, William James' comment, you know, about religious peak experiences. No longer is that the case. And of course, having trusted in Christ, committed his life to Christ, immediately he wants to immerse himself in serious Christian discipleship. And he begins reading Thomas Aquinas' great medieval classic, Imitation of Christ. He begins practicing the spiritual disciplines. And the effects on Lewis's life are really remarkable. Reluctantly, but obediently, he attends church regularly. He submits to the authority of his pastor. And furthermore, God gives him an incredible gift. God gives him a vision for evangelism. But he understands we can only do evangelism effectively in our culture if we integrate apologetics, because it's really not sufficient just to share your own subjective faith experience with others. We have to objectify our subjective experience. We have to point to realities above and beyond just our own experience as to why people should believe in, to use Lewis's terminology, the Christian myth. Again, it's not legend. It is mythology, but it's also history. It was actually fulfilled. So let me close with this. One of his biographers writes, "Jack's conversion to Christianity made him a different person. His search for belief was over. He now had a strong platform on which to stand. And he devotes himself..." Boy, he is just so focused most of the rest of his life. "He devotes himself to developing and strengthening his belief, and almost from the year of his conversion, he wants to become an evangelist for the Christian faith." And again, he looks around at his corrupt culture, England in the 1930s and 40s, and he sees that it is forfeiting this rich Christian heritage that has come before it. It's becoming increasingly secularized. It's becoming increasingly engulfed in skepticism and immorality. And he's very concerned that if the gospel of Jesus Christ is going to be delivered with any sort of clarity and effect, it has to come through making the case for the truth of the faith, as well as sharing our own experiences in Christ. I think we have about 2 minutes. Comments, questions? 7 seconds is about up. Let's see here. We go. Anything? I just find this an incredibly inspiring story. The man was really, frankly, messed up. By the time he's a teenager, he's been so corrupted by this world and is so angry at God and a hardcore non-believer. And to see the way God softens his heart, opens up his mind, is just an incredible testimony to the grace and goodness of God. And Dave, I understand next week we'll be doing a summary of Mere Christianity. So very much looking forward to continuing the study with you. Thank you, and blessings on your week.